Welcome to today's reading of the Counsel Plus Nonpareil for Tuesday, March 12th, 2024. I'm your reader, John McPartland. Here's our first story. Waterfest Making a Splash. Library brings together community to celebrate water. The Council Bluffs Public Library's Waterfest made quite the splash Saturday, especially with the younger crowd. I learned about nature a lot, 7-year-old Marlo Grzowski told the Nonpareil while attending the kickoff Saturday for the library's Our Community Reads program. The event explored the importance of water and how it impacts the natural world. For Marlo, the lesson included learning with a certain type of bee associated with a certain flower. It's the minor bee, she said. The event was planned around this year's Our Community Reads theme, Water Connects Us All. The program runs throughout March and April. During this time, the library is encouraging adults and kids to read a book focusing on water. Adults are encouraged to read Riverman by Ben McGrath. There are two youth selections, Ocean Waves for All and Sunny Makes a Splash. The library will host McGrath on April 16th for a public discussion on his work, while the two youth authors, Stacy McNaughty and Jennifer Holm, will speak to students at Council Bluffs during that month, while students would take home a copy of their respected authors' books. There was much to learn for adults and children alike at Saturday's event. In the parking lot, the Council Bluffs Fire Department brought out its water rescue hovercraft, offering kids a chance to sit inside for a close-up look. We were the first ones in this area to have one, firefighter Zach Sadley said. It is ideal for ice water rescue and during flooding. It is another tool in our toolbox. The Council Bluffs Public Works Department also brought its sewer cam, showing kids how that works when inspecting the city's sewer system. Inside, there was plenty of educational activities on topics such as water safety, the history of the Missouri River, and creating healthy soil. Children also got to make wave sticks and watercolor painting. Angela Greiner, a small business owner and Council Bluffs resident, represented Council Bluffs Bee City, USA. We got designated as a Bee City in 2022, she said. It's a collaboration between the City of Council Bluffs, Pottawatomie County, volunteers, and the library, Greiner said. The program reflects the important roles bees play in daily life. It's neat to them to work together on greater habitats for bees to thrive, she said. They pollinate a lot of our fruits and vegetables. Greiner said it's important for residents to consider native plants in their gardens. Native plants usually need less water to grow and use less fertilizer, she said. Her daughter, Emma Jean, added, a lot of bees vary in size and some look like flies. Native bumblebees nest in the ground and usually live alone. Bees are important to the environment, Emma Jean said. Now we've got a story by Julie Anderson of the Omaha World Herald, Flood of 2019. Hamburg and Pacific Junction still recovering. 5 years ago, this weekend, southwest Iowa, along with the larger region, faced historic flooding. The flood swamped or threatened roads, railroad tracks, and other critical infrastructure in the area. It destroyed homes and businesses, killed livestock, and ravaged farmland. Across an 8-state region, damages totaled $13.1 billion from a historical event considered one of the costliest U.S. inland flooding events on record. The Missouri River peaked at 34.4 feet in downtown Omaha on March 17, 2019, according to the National Weather Service. That's nearly 2 feet lower than the crest during the 2011 flood, but enough to land 2019 the number 3 spot on the city's all-time flood crest chart. This week's anniversary of the flood is more than an opportunity to remember the devastating event and the efforts still underway to rebuild and recover. It's also a chance to examine whether the region and its residents have emerged better protected and better prepared for the next flood. The exact confluence of weather conditions in 2019, bitter cold, heavy snow, and already sodden, frozen soils, followed by a rapid warm-up and a bomb cyclone, creating an arguably unique disaster. But it's also a certainty that major floods can and will happen again in this region carved by water, particularly with a warming planet fueling more frequent and potent storms. Local officials say the region is more prepared for another flood of the same magnitude, although there is still work to be completed. Sizable pieces of damaged infrastructure have been rebuilt, many to a higher standard than before. The Army Corps of Engineers has been conducting what's known as the Lower Missouri River Flood Risk and Resiliency Study to reassess the flood risk on the Lower Missouri River from Yankton, South Dakota to Herman, Missouri. The study does not address management of the upstream dams. After the 2019 floods on the Lower Missouri, the Corps was urged by the governors of Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and Missouri to do something different when it came to flood resiliency. As part of the study, the Corps also is updating flow and stage frequencies on the lower river in order to provide accurate tools for flood risk management. Colleen Roberts, a program manager with the Corps Kansas City District Office, said the agency now has two more decades of data than the last time it examined flows in 2013. In general, the agency is seeing more extremes in high flows and low flows. The agency has identified some problem spots and this summer began to talk about possible solutions and who can address them, she said. A draft of the study will be available in 2025, followed by the completed study in 2027. Despite all the repairs completed so far, however, work remains to protect communities along rivers, and weaknesses will remain even after scheduled work is done. Iowa plans to seek out potential levee weak spots, which could lead to opportunities for upgrades. The state launched an Office of Levee Safety with its Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in June as part of the larger levee improvement program. Levee safety officials, who met recently with residents in Council Bluffs and Sydney, are tasked with analyzing the condition of the state's levees and developing a rating scale to identify those most at risk. Iowa Geological Survey will survey nearly 900 miles of levees in the coming years. For residents of hard-hit communities, flood recovery efforts remain front and center, and the drama lingers. In others, the pandemic, the passage of time, and several years of drought have eroded memories of the 2019 event. Pacific Junction mayor keeps positive. 5 years after the floods, Pacific Junction in Mills County now is home to just under 100 residents, about three-quarters its former number. But Mayor Andy Young still is working to rebuild. He returned to his home, which took on 9 feet of water, in February of 2020, after getting his daughter's house back in shape. Recently, he's been working to create another temporary space for a city office in an old ambulance building. It has been situated in a quarter of a building owned by the city clerk, who hopes to open a bar and restaurant there by the end of May. Another bar opened several months ago, and a model train club is remodeling a building and hopes to open this summer. Later this month, the village plans to start selling some of the 36 lots it brought back from FEMA, with the aim at increasing the population and the tax base. There's always times when it's a struggle, Young, 69, said. You can't let it bother you. You just have to move on and keep positive. Because if you're not positive, everybody around you gets down. There's a long list of tasks in Hamburg. Hamburg has seen its share of floods. In March 2019, Harry Adams realized he was filling sandbags about 10 feet from where he performed the same task as a youngster in 1952. Now Hamburg's mayor, Adams moved back after a long tech career in the Chicago area about 2 years before the flood, is among those helping to shore up the town. About half the Fremont County community flooded after multiple levee breaks. Nearly 70 houses were lost and are being bought out by FEMA. The Corps repaired the levee between the town and the Missouri River above what it was called for in federal standards. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds noted during a December meeting in Omaha with the Corps and the governors of Nebraska and Missouri. But Adams said the water rose higher than projected in March of 2019. It's really hard to imagine the expanse of land that was flooded. It's hard to believe that happened. The community, however, has bounced back. Not only have hard-hit mainstay businesses, including AgriVision Equipment and Hendrickson Enterprises, cleaned up and forged on, the town has added 11 new ones, including a bank, a Dollar General store, and a new motel. People can come to town and be proud. A 24-unit apartment building has been renovated and construction has begun on a new housing development on the northeast edge of town that will offer 33 affordable houses. But as in many impacted communities, there are still streets to repair, ball fields to fix, and parks to restore. Another item on the town's punch list is finding a way to improve an area along Interstate 29 to block flood threats from the Nishnabotna River. Currently, part of the interstate serves as a levee. We have some fun things to do, but our list of to-dos is long, Adam said. Luther College Symphony Orchestra to perform next week at Thomas Jefferson. The Luther College Symphony Orchestra, under the direction of Daniel Baldwin, will perform at 7:30 p.m. Friday, March 15th, at Thomas Jefferson High School in Council Bluffs. The concert, which is open to the public with a free will donation at the door, is part of the Symphony Orchestra's Spring 2024 tour, according to a news release. The program begins with three dance episodes from Leonard Bernstein's On the Town. The orchestra will once again perform Pelléas et Mélisande Suite, Op. 80, by Gabriel Ferrari, along with Introduction and Gobach, from The Fair at Sorinsky, by Modest Mussorgsky. The group is the DeCorps-based college's oldest orchestral ensemble, is one of the four main touring ensembles. In addition to domestic appearances, the symphony maintains a three-week residency in Vienna every few years. More than 70 student musicians perform with the orchestra. Many are also involved in the chamber music, choir, band, or jazz ensemble. The symphony had a month-long residency in Vienna, Austria, in 2019 and 2023. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is investigating a soybean byproduct spill in a tributary of the Boyer River in Harrison County. The DNR Atlantic Field Office was notified Friday about a transportation truck losing control, spilling a feed additive called soybean soap stock, according to a news release. The additive is a byproduct obtained during refining crude soybean oil. It consists of fatty acids suitable for soap production. X Transportation LLC was carrying about 40,100 pounds of product when the truck rolled off the road due to icy road conditions and released an unknown amount of product. Upon release, the product reached an unnamed tributary of the Boyer River. Cleanup efforts began Friday. The tributary has been dammed. Booms have been placed about 250 feet downstream, and a pumper truck was removing the product from the tributary for proper disposal. The byproduct did not reach the Boyer. No injuries were reported and no dead fish were observed. Water samples were collected. The investigation is ongoing. Additionally, the DNR is investigating a diesel spill on the Middle Nottoway River. The DNR Atlantic Field Office received a call Friday from an Adair County Conservation Officer reporting a red sheen on an unnamed tributary located on G-27 between Indian and Jordan Avenues in Adair County, according to a news release. DNR staff discovered that diesel had overflowed from a vent tube in an above-ground storage tank at a farm operation owned by Cading Land Company. The discharged diesel reach a stormwater intake located inside the secondary containment area and continued flowing via field tile, eventually reaching an unnamed tributary of the Middle Nottoway River. The amount of diesel spilled is unknown. No dead fish were observed. Midlands Humane Society gets $60,000 grant from PetSmart. Midlands Humane Society has received a $60,000 grant from PetSmart Charities to help prepare more pets in Pottawatomie County for adoption. Some 4 million pets find themselves in U.S. shelters each year. In partnership with PetSmart Charities, Midlands Humane Society will bring adoptable pets to the Council Bluffs PetSmart in support of National Adoption Week, taking place March 18th through March 24th. Our partnership with the Council Bluffs PetSmart stores began in 2015 and in Omaha in 2019, where we house approximately 6 to 10 adoptable animals between the two locations weekly, said Nikki Cruikshank, MHS Executive Director. We highly value being able to bring pets to PetSmart stores for housing and adoptions. Not only does it provide these adoptable pets with additional exposure by reaching unique populations of potential adopters, but it also frees up kennel space for other animals back at the shelter. MHS is proud and deeply appreciative of our relationship with PetSmart stores and PetSmart charities. Thanks to their generous support, we have been able to expand our reach, prepare more animals for adoption, and find more of our animals' new homes. This is especially true for Fire, a 4-year-old boxer mix who had been with MHS for nearly an entire year. Fire, who had been living in a foster home, attended a PetSmart adoption event, and it was love at first sight for the adopters. They knew right away that Fire would be the perfect fit for their family, and she went home with them the very same day. Shelters across the U.S. are struggling to keep pace with the number of animals coming in and need support from their communities to bring pets and people together, said Heidi Marston, Director of Pet Placement at PetSmart Charities. We're proud to support Midlands Humane Society and the essential work they do to care and advocate for the animals that come through their door in need of loving families. Please consider supporting their life-saving work through volunteering, fostering, adopting, or by making a donation. PetSmart Charities National Adoption Week is a special time during the year. PetSmart stores feature adoptable pets to meet and cuddle in spacious areas, and staff and volunteers are on hand to make introductions and answer questions. Potential pet parents can also learn about the products and services they'll need for the best possible start with their new family members. For more information on adopting, fostering, volunteering, donating, upcoming events, and more, visit the Midlands Humane Society website at midlandshumanesociety.org/ADOPT. Adoptable pets will be available at the PetSmart location in Council Bluffs on March 19th, March 21st, and March 24th from noon to 3 p.m. Missing dogs reunited with the owner. Pets run away all the time. If you're lucky, yours will come back on its own or maybe get picked up by a neighbor. If you're less lucky, your pup could get picked up by animal control and sent to the local humane society. In theory, that outcome shouldn't be too much trouble. However, in practice, it can become an ineffectual quest, not unlike that of Don Quixote's imaginary windmills. That's exactly the experience Marlon Taylor had, and it almost cost him one of the two dogs he raised, since they were puppies from the same litter. On the evening of Sunday, February 4th, Taylor was in the middle of moving from an Omaha motel off 108th Street to extended stay motel near South 118th Street. Taylor, who was studying to become a real estate agent, was in between homes after he fell behind on his rent. Upon returning to the 108th Street motel after dropping off the last of his stuff at the new place, Taylor discovered that his boys, Kratos and King, 3-year-old Kane Corsos, were missing. The motel manager told me they were gone. He came to my room with his phone and he showed me on the hotel video camera how the dogs had pawed their way out of the door and ran off in two different directions, out two different doors. What happened over the next 3 weeks became an almost Keystone Cops farce that thankfully had a mostly happy ending. Taylor said he was already familiar with the Nebraska Humane Society. Kratos, my black dog, is a runner, and there's been two other occasions where he's taken off from where I was at or from where I was staying, Taylor said. So as soon as I realized that they had taken off, I immediately sent an email to the Humane Society letting them know that the dogs had taken off and could they please contact me immediately if they saw them. The following day, Taylor received a phone call from NHS Animal Control telling him that they had picked up Kratos. I gave her my address, and she showed up, and she brought him straight home, Taylor said. That's when I asked her, hey, do you know anything about my brown one? The woman from Animal Control told Taylor that King had been picked up the night before, the night the two dogs had run off, and was already at NHS. With Kratos back in his care, Taylor called NHS to see about arranging to pick up King. I didn't get an answer, so I left a detailed message explaining that I had just talked to the lady, and she told me that my dog was there, and I wanted to verify that my dog was there, Taylor said. Taylor currently doesn't have a car of his own, or else he would have driven straight to NHS, so he waited for someone at the Humane Society to get back to him. Despite the email and phone messages, Taylor didn't hear from anyone at NHS until the following week, which proved to be too late. On Thursday, February 8th, as Taylor was waiting for NHS to contact him, Krajan Caldwell visited the Humane Society with a friend who was interested in getting a dog. Caldwell, who was living with an uncle, already had a puppy of her own. When Caldwell saw King in the kennel, I was like, oh my God, this is like the perfect dog. He's so sweet, he doesn't bark, he has like the cutest face ever. Caldwell returned home to pick up her dog, Luna, and brought her back to NHS to see how she and the perfect dog got along. The two dogs apparently got on well because Caldwell paid a $35 licensing fee and adopted the dog, with whom she named Mocha. Unfortunately, given her present circumstances, life with Mocha was more difficult than Caldwell had anticipated. Turns out it wasn't the smartest idea, Caldwell said, so I reached out to some friends and family. I was like, hey, you know, I got a dog, adopted a dog, and I can't keep it at my place. So my uncle friends gave me the link to Country Kennel, and she was like, these people are amazing. They take pride in what they do. Go talk to them. Caldwell brought Mocha to S&B Country Kennel in Council Bluffs on Wednesday, February 14th. She had just adopted the dog, and she didn't have a place for the dog, Country Kennel owner Joe Huntoon told the nonpareil. She was living in an apartment with somebody else or in somebody else's apartment, and she had another dog already at home. So why would she adopt this dog? Huntoon said they had a feeling Caldwell wasn't going to be able to keep up with the payments for boarding the dog. I'm like, this dog's probably going to end up staying here, Huntoon said. Like she's going to rack up a bill. She's going to leave the dog. A few days later, on Saturday, February 17th, a Country Kennel employee named Jason Bloget told his boss that he had just seen a Facebook post about a missing dog that looked an awful lot like Mocha. Bloget said he first saw the post a few days earlier, but as soon as he saw Mocha in the kennel, he noticed the similarities of the Facebook post. Meanwhile, a few days before Caldwell brought Mocha to the Country Kennel, on Monday, February 12th, Taylor finally received the phone call from NHS that he'd been waiting for. That's when the lady called me back and she said, I'm so sorry that I'm just now hearing your messages and getting back to you. How can I help you? Taylor said, I explained my situation to her. The woman who called from NHS checked their records looking for a dog named King, but nothing came up. She said, I'm going to dig into this, Taylor said. She said, I'm going to talk to my manager and I'm going to dig into this further and I'm going to call you back. 5 days later, Taylor still hadn't received the call, so he finally took matters into his own hands and asked a friend to drive him over to the Nebraska Humane Society offices on 90th and Fort on Saturday, February 17th. I pleaded my case to the lady at the counter. She asked me my name, and she's looking through the emails, and she's like, is this about King? And I said, yes, yes, ma'am, this is about my dog King. The woman from the counter went and spoke with a colleague, and then suddenly her and the lady were whispering. After they got done whispering, the lady came back to me and told me to meet her around the side and that she was going to walk me through all the kennels, Taylor said. I walked through the 8 kennels, and of course, I didn't find my dog. At this point, Taylor contacted the Facebook group, Lost Pets of Omaha Area, which partners with the Humane Society to help people find lost pets, and explained the situation. It just so happened that the lady that answered me on Facebook is the same person that has been a customer of mine, Taylor said. Since the pandemic, Taylor has been making and selling T-shirts and other merchandise printed with the phrase, Kindness Destroys Hate, to raise money for families in need. She immediately recognized who she was talking to, and she told me she's going to do everything she can. The next day, Tuesday, February 20th, she called Taylor and told him his dog had been adopted. Distraught, Taylor returned to Facebook and posted an update. "He's gone. In the process of me playing tag and trying to speak to a human, he was immediately adopted out after the third day. No clue who or where to." Not 30 months, 30 minutes later, Blojet, the country kennel employee, responded to Taylor's post. "I sent him a picture of the dog that was here, and he's like, immediately, that's my dog." Blojet looped his boss, Huntoon, into the conversation, and they tried to figure out a way to prove that the dog in the care was actually Taylor's missing dog. Taylor offered to get a ride from a friend and bring Kratos, King's brother, with him, thinking that when Kratos and King see each other for the first time in nearly 3 weeks, it would be obvious that they know each other. On Thursday, February 21st, Taylor and Kratos got a ride to the S&B Country Kennel for the reunion with King. Shortly after Taylor arrived at the kennel, Huntoon received a phone call from Caldwell, who said she wanted to bring her other dog, Luna, to the kennel to play with Mocha. Finally, the star-crossed dog owners would be able to talk face-to-face. When Taylor and Kratos got to the kennel, Huntoon took them to the field out back the building before going to get Mocha from his kennel. "Me and Kratos waited in the big field, and then they thought we waited a safe distance away. Then they brought King out into the field, and he was laying on the ground, and Huntoon was petting him, which was good because I wanted him to be distracted before noticing us." From the other side of the field, Taylor called out, "Hey, baby," and King took off running toward him and Kratos. "The dog jumped up and just zoomed across the whole field straight to me," Taylor said. Taylor said he heard Huntoon saying in the background that Mocha was in fact King. With Taylor's furry family back together, it was time to speak with Caldwell, who, after adopting King from the Humane Society, was his legal owner. He was just like, "You know, I've had him since he was a puppy. He showed me all these pictures, and then he showed me the emails and the calls to Humane Society." Huntoon asked Caldwell what she wanted to do given the situation. "I paid for all the stuff. I adopted him. He's my dog now. But I've had times where my dogs have gotten out and ended up at NHS, and somebody has adopted them. And the Humane Society was like, 'Well, you don't have a license, so we can't prove that it's yours,'" Caldwell said. "I kind of floated back into that part of my life where I was like, 'Okay, do I keep this dog because I fell in love with it, or do I give it back to the person that raised it since he was a puppy?' And in that moment, I was just like, 'I've only had him for 2 weeks. This is like his family.'" Taylor gave Caldwell $45 to cover the cost of adopting the dog and a bag of dog food that she had bought. When the ordeal was over and King and Kratos were reunited, Taylor was almost at a loss. "It was tears, bro. It was tears," he said. "The best way I can describe it is like having one of my kids missing." Despite only being in his care for about a week, King definitely made an impression on Huntoon, especially when he saw King playing with his brother. "I told Taylor, if anything happens to those dogs, you let me know and I will help you out like a guardian angel, if you will," Huntoon said. "Now you've made a friend type thing. These dogs are great and they're innocent of the whole thing." You are listening to the Council Bluffs Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, John McPartland. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS programs, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First one we have is Sandy Jane Saladin. Sandra Sandy Jean Saladin, age 62, of Wood River, Nebraska, passed away Friday, March 8th, at Grand Island Regional Medical Center, surrounded by her loving family. A celebration of life service will be held Thursday, March 14th at 3 p.m. at All Faith's Funeral Home. The service will be live streamed on the funeral home website. Visitation will be held 2 hours prior to the service at the funeral home. Memorials suggested to the family for future designation. Condolences can be left at www.giall.org. FAITHS.com. The family is asking everyone to dress in either Kansas City Chiefs attire or racing attire. Sandra Jean was born in Council Bluffs on November 4, 1961, to Ruth Ann Collins and William E. Huff, Sr. She graduated from Underwood, Iowa High School in 1980. She attended Dana College in Blair, Nebraska, and graduated in 1984 with double majors in elementary education, K-6, and educatable mentally handicapped, K-9. After graduation, she worked in a variety of medical fields, podiatrist, anesthesiologist, and Jenny Edmondson Memorial Hospital. She started working for Omaha VA Medical Center in September 1989. She was later transferred to Grand Island VA Medical Center, where she worked in a variety of positions. In May of 1994, Sandy was united in marriage to Tracy Saladin. They were blessed with their first daughter in November 1994. The family moved to Wood River in November 1996, and they were blessed with their second daughter in January of 1997. She became active with her girls' school activities, where she was a room mom, Girl Scout leader, teammate mentor, involved with PTO, and most recently, the FOOV Pantry Backpack Program. She loved following their school activities, with one of her favorite sports being softball. She participated in Relay for Life, where she was also the Hall County team coordinator. Sandy was always a dedicated Kansas City Chiefs football fan, and she was an avid dirt track racing fan with her parents. Sandy loved to do crafts and photography. She is survived by her husband, Tracy, daughters, Sarah and Mallory, mother, Ruth Ann Huff, brother, William Billy Huff, Jr., nephews and nieces. She loved Christmas and giving gifts. She loved to spoil children and had a special place in her heart for Gavin and Lydia Fronson, Scarlett and Carson Lambert. She was preceded in death by her dad, William Sr., in July of 2019. Next we have Ronald Ron Grolfs, May 16, 1935 to March 10, 2024. Ronald Ron Grolfs, age 88, passed away peacefully with his family by his side on March 10, 2024, at Hanson House in Council Bluffs, under the care of Every Step Hospice. Ron was born May 16, 1935, to Ed and Alyssa Groffs in Council Bluffs. He was raised on the family farm. He attended country school at Hardin Township for several years and graduated from Trainer High School in 1953. He wed the love of his life, Eileen Goose, on July 6, 1956, at Zion Congregational Church in Trainer, Iowa. After their marriage, Ron and Eileen settled on the family farm. Ron was in the National Guard, served on the Trainer School Board, and worked with the Pottawatomie County ASCS. Ron and Eileen retired from the farm in 1998 and moved to Council Bluffs. During retirement, Ron loved drives out in the country, countless meals with friends and family at Duncan's Cafe, and continued to be an avid toy tractor enthusiast. He was preceded in death by his wife of 65 years, Eileen, his parents, son David, brother Eugene, sister Philip, and sister Marilyn in infancy. He is survived by his children, Diane Groffs, Maury of Grundy Center, Michael Lisa Groffs of Urbandale, grandchildren Thomas Maury, Samantha Maury, Noah and Raina Groffs, great-grandchildren Spencer, Sylvia, Isabel, and Casey. In lieu of flowers and memories can be directed to Every Step Hospice or Zion Congregational Church. Visitation Friday, 10 to 11 a.m., followed by memorial service at 11 a.m., all at the funeral home. Ron will be laid out to rest in Cedar Lawn Cemetery, followed by a luncheon at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. Now we move on to a little sports. The Nonpareil proudly presents its inaugural out-of-city boys basketball team, where we recognize the best of the best players outside of Council Bluffs. The list was constructed off of postseason awards and the Nonpareil staff observations. Without further ado, here's the first ever out-of-city boys basketball team. The starters, we have Grady Jeppesen, senior from Riverside. Grady was a scoring machine, period. He led the whole coverage area, averaging 25.5 points per game while shooting 36.6% behind the arc. However, the kid could do more than just score, as he also led the team in rebounding and assists and steals. Yes, the guy could do a bit of everything, hence why he was named Western Iowa Conference Player of the Year. We have Jace Tams, senior and trainer. Tams was a big part of Trainer's run to the 2A state semifinal. Tams led the Cardinals with 18.7 points per game. There was no shot in the attacking half court that was out of his range. Tams also led the team with 2 assists per game and 2.7 steals. Tams was second team 2A All-State selection after his solid senior season. We have Caden Anderson. He's a senior from Glenwood. Anderson led the Rams with 15.5 points per contest, chipped in with about 4.3 rebounds, and led with 3.7 assists and led with 2.4 steals. All this considered made Anderson first team All-Hawkeye 10 selection. Offense and defense, Anderson was a reliable force for the Rams team that placed in the top 4 of the always challenging Hawk 10. We have Mason Boothby, senior from Underwood. Among 5 players who averaged about 10 points per game or more, Boothby led the flock with 13.7 points per game. The senior was a 2A third-team All-State selection, as he also led the team in assists per game and steals per game. He chipped in with 3.3 rebounds per contest as well. A true quality player that was a big part of Underwood's historical state tournament run. And last we have Jake Van Fossen, senior of Underwood. The fact Van Fossen averaged a double-double through the season, 10.7 points and 10.2 rebounds for the third consecutive season, could alone serve as a plentiful explanation why Van Fossen is on this list. He also distributed the ball well, averaging 4.4 assists per game. Van Fossen was rewarded with a spot on the WIC's first all-conference. And we have a story about Iowa Hawkeye women. Caitlin Clark sparks number 3 Iowa's comeback for Big Ten tournament title three-peat. Caitlin Clark overcame a cold start to score 30 of her 34 points after halftime and helped third-ranked Iowa rally past Nebraska 94-89 in overtime to win a third straight Big Ten tournament on Sunday. "It never gets old cutting the net," Clark said, after black and gold confetti covered the court at Target Center, to the delight of another sellout crowd packed with Hawkeye fans. "I feel like we're pretty good at that." Hannah Stokey had 25 points and 9 rebounds for Iowa, which trailed by 13 points late in the first half, while their superstar Clark missed all 9 of her 3-point attempts. "You can maybe keep Caitlin down for a half, but you're not keeping her down for a whole game," Hawkeye coach Lisa Bluter said. The all-time NCAA leading scorer finished 5-for-17 from deep, had 12 assists, and hit the dagger three-pointer with 51 seconds left in overtime for an 89-87 lead, just 16 seconds after Logan Nisley's three-pointer put the Cornhuskers in front. "I knew some shots were going to go in," Clark said. "That's just how it works." Alexis Markowski had 23 points and 13 rebounds to lead Nebraska in a valiant performance that fell short of a second victory over Iowa this season. The Huskers beat the Hawkeyes 82-79 on February 11th. "Nobody else did, but we expected to win," said Nebraska coach Amy Williams, who had tears streaming down her face at the postgame interview podium as she praised Nisley's effort after her red-eye players choked up during some of her remarks. Natalie Potts had 21 points and 9 rebounds for the Huskers, who are playing in their 4th game in 4 days after beating Purdue, Michigan State, and Maryland to reach the conference final for the first time in 10 years. In Big Ten wrestling, Iowa gains 3 third-place finishes at Big Ten tournament. Zach Glazier, Iowa's lone wrestler in the Big Ten Finals on Sunday in College Park, Maryland, was unable to finish it off. Top-seeded Aaron Brooks opened a 6-1 first-period lead thanks to two takedowns. The Nittany Lion product added another takedown in the second period and three more in the third for a 19-3 victory win by technical overall. Overall, Iowa finished fourth with 109.5 points. Penn State took home top honors, with Michigan in second and Nebraska rounding out the top three. The Hawkeyes earned three third-place honors. Drake Ayala, 125, ranked number two nationally, defeated Matt Ramos of Purdue 4-1. Ayala had an early takedown of Ramos in the first period and did not look back for the win. Rhea Woods, the third-ranked wrestler at his weight class in the country, also claimed a third-place finish, but his consolation finals match against Michigan's Siegel Lemley went down to the wire. Woods was up 7-0 in the first period after a takedown and a near fall, but a third-period takedown by Lemley cut the deficit 10-7. Woods was able to pull away late for the 11-8 win. Michael Calandia, ranked 6th nationally, needed overtime in his consolation finals match versus Cameron Amin of Michigan to get the victory. Michael was leading 5-4 heading into the third period, but an early escape by Amin sent the match into overtime. A takedown allowed Michael to claim the Hawkeyes' third-place finish on Sunday. At 157, Iowa's Jared Franek medically forfeited to Peyton Robb of Nebraska. Elsewhere, Bettendorf's Bradley Hill placed 5th at 285, beating Nash Hushmaker of Nebraska 4-1. The Hawkeyes also got 5th-place finishes from Patrick Kennedy, Caleb Rothgen, and Brody Teske. Now we have a few opinions. First one is by Daniel J. Stone. Stone is an internist and geriatrician in Beverly Hills. He wrote this for the Los Angeles Times. What a doctor sees when the president hesitates. As a geriatrician, I discuss the effects of aging with patients every day. I wish I had a chance to give my usual talk to everyone who chortles or tears a hair out after President Joe Biden's fitness for this job. Three components of memory should be considered. One is formation, then storage, and finally recall. The most common issues among seniors is slow recall. That is the familiar tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon when a word seems to hide or a name won't come to mind. Given time, it usually arrives. This problem, called age-associated memory impairment, often starts for people in their 30s and gradually progresses. It's a nuance, but not disabling. If, like me, you find yourself using the term whatchamacallit, you probably have it. Don't worry, you'll be fine. Alzheimer's disease, the most common cause of dementia, is different. Those affected lose their ability to store memories. They can still access old memories in their memory bank, and many recount events that occurred decades ago, but they can't tell you what they had for breakfast, because that never entered the memory bank. I reassure my patients with age-associated memory impairment by asking whether they remember their breakfast. They do. Alzheimer's is cognitively crippling. Losing the ability to form new memories freezes one in time. Those affected can't make new friends or address new situations without fresh memories. Additionally, the disease progressively impairs other domains, including behavior and ultimately physical skills. Fortunately, President Biden shows no signs of Alzheimer's disease. At news conferences, he references new events and obviously creates new memories efficiently. He speaks slowly and pauses to find words like others with benign age-associated memory impairment. These issues are exacerbated by a chronic speech impediment. Biden has struggled with stuttering since childhood and remnants of this condition have been long apparent in his speech. Unfortunately, word hesitations coupled with the mild stutter can't help but affect his public speaking. Biden's political opponents exploit it with stereotypes about older people to create a false narrative about intellectual impairment. I take care of many high-functioning seniors like Biden in my practice. One that I know who is not a patient of mine has been my family's lawyers for 5 decades. Melvin Spears, at 96, recently responded to an emailed legal question with succinct and well-targeted advice, as he always has. When I spoke to him, he acknowledged some concessions to his age. He speaks more slowly, and transportation is a challenge because he stopped driving. Studies show that high-functioning seniors like Spears and the president compensate for slower reaction time by applying superior knowledge and judgment. The presidency is not a job that requires lightning-quick reflexes. Actuarial tables show that the 81-year-old president's life expectancy extends nearly 8 years, well beyond a second term. He gets excellent health care, has no major chronic illnesses, and at his recent physical at Walter Reed Military Medical Center, he was declared healthy, active, and fit for duty. All that means Biden is likely to beat the actuary estimates. Given his overall health and the absence of current cognitive impairment, he would likely complete a second term with a stable cognition. If the American people disagree with President Biden's policies and prefer change, they should support his opponent. But in the absence of valid evidence of true cognitive impairment, their judgment should not be influenced by ageist social stereotypes. Biden and the American political process deserve better. Here's another view from the Quad City Times. Clark, a remarkable transformational athlete. Breaking long-held records and barriers and scaling obstacles to open doors to new possibilities, both Caitlin Clark and Solomon Butler changed the world around them. Most of us are lucky to make some small impact on the people closest to us. Caitlin Clark has changed women's basketball, entertained hundreds of thousands, and inspired a generation of young athletes. All the while, she's acknowledged those around her and has lacked the hubris we might expect from the all-time leading scorer in the NCAA Division I basketball, who helps sell out arenas wherever she plays. Clark isn't just a scorer. She's a team leader and a team player, known for her sharp passes to teammates. She leads the Big Ten in a career assists and ranks 15th for career assists in the NCAA. The way Clark scores is also game-changing. She broke the NCAA women's scoring record with a 35-foot three-pointer. Keep in mind, the NBA three-point line at the top of the key is 23 feet and 9 inches. According to CBB Analytics, Clark has hit 84 three-pointers this season from beyond 25 feet. She sank 76 from that distance last season. The next 7 players with the most long threes since 2018, when the stat began being tracked, are all for men. All across Iowa and beyond, girls are sporting Clark's 22 on shirts and jackets. They are motivated by Clark's accomplishments. Seeing is believing. Clark is a remarkable, transformational, once-in-a-generation athlete. Clark's exceptional feats were made possible by pioneers in women's basketball, such as Lynette Woodard and Pearl Moore, who remain the top scorer in the Association of Intercollegiate Athletes for Women. Before the 1981-82 season, the NCAA didn't recognize or fund women's basketball. Sometimes the spotlight eludes the Trailblazers or flickers out prematurely. Joni Ernst seeks number 3 GOP leadership job. Ashley Murray of the Iowa Capitol Dispatch. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa will face Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas in the race to become the next Senate Republican Conference chair, her office confirmed Monday. Ernst, if elected, would move up one spot in the Senate GOP leadership lineup and be the first woman to hold the position for the party since 1973. Ernst is already number four as chair of the Republican Policy Committee. Cotton and Ernst both won midterm races in 2014 to help bring a Republican majority to the Senate during former President Barack Obama's second term. Both are veterans and have served overseas. An announcement by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky that he would step down from his post in November opened opportunities for a new era of Republican leadership in the upper chamber. Ernst first told Politico Sunday about her decision to run for the number three position. Her office did not provide a statement Monday, but told Politico, "This is winnable for me." The second-term senator and veteran of the Army Reserve and Iowa National Guard would be the second woman ever in the Republican Party to sit as a conference chair. Ernst took office on January 3, 2015, and currently sits as ranking member of the Senate Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship. Ernst also serves as a member of the Armed Services as well as the Agricultural, Nutritional, and Forestry Committees. We're going to finish up with what to watch on Tuesday, March 12th. We have TNT is NBA basketball beginning at 6:30 p.m. NBC 7 p.m. we have Night Court. In new episodes, Wheelers of Fortune surprises are in store for Dan when the Wheelers return to court after more than 30 years. Meanwhile, Abby seeks a psychic in hopes of ending an argument that she had with her late father, Brent Spiner. Annie O'Donnell, Kate Micucci, and Julie Sweeney guest star. Let's see, on NBC at 8 o'clock, we have The Voice. The coaches continue their search for the best undiscovered voice in America on the final night of the blind auditions. NBC at 9 p.m., we have Password. Jimmy Fallon and Emmy-winning host Kiki Palmer are back for Season 2 of this latest incarnation of the classic game show. Hour-long episodes will include two back-to-back games with recurring player Fallon paired with a contestant competing against a celebrity guest contestant duel for cash prizes by guessing a secret password using only one-word clues. This season's celebrity guests include Chance the Rapper, Laverne Cox, Lauren Graham, Jimmy Kimmel, Howie Mandel, Meghan Trainor, and more. NBC, I guess I missed this one, 7:30, Extended Family. When Jim embellishes his yoga abilities to impress a woman, Julie must step in to save him from looking like a fool in this new episode, The Consequences of Writing Things Down. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Blessed Nonpareil. I'm your reader, John McPartland. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.